From WUOT News, this is The Method, a series exploring the intersection of science and society. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Later in the program, we'll meet one of the 8,000 students who converged here in Knoxville last week for a program that teaches problem solving through science and design. But first, East Tennessee is big damn country. Well, you know what I mean. Melton Hill, Norris, Douglas, Fort Loudoun, and many others. Some were built for flood control, some of them for navigation, but many of those dams were built for the purpose of making electricity. These days, hydroelectric power is seen as a clean and renewable source of electricity, both here in Tennessee and throughout the nation. Chrissy Kuiper recently met two researchers at Oak Ridge National Lab who have been surveying the state of hydroelectric power sources across the country.
Rocio Oria Martinez and Patrick O'Connor are researchers and energy analysts at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. They've co-authored the first major report on the nation's existing hydropower fleet and market, as well as its history. Oria Martinez says the report is timely for two reasons. First, there's been renewed interest in hydropower in the last 30 years, and second,
I think there was a need for it. I mean, hydropower is the largest and the oldest source of renewable electricity in the United States. And yet there was no one document where you could go and get a comprehensive, detailed account of the fleet, of its characteristics, and also discussing recent performance and development trends in hydropower.
The authors found that along with the larger facilities that power millions of homes, there are lots of smaller micropower facilities, which are the oldest power producers in the country.
Micro hydro, in terms of generation, is like up to 0.1 megawatts.
Probably powering 50 to 100 homes, roughly, would be these small little, the larger small plants would do that, versus something like Hoover or Grand Coulee, which are powering millions, potentially.
For these micro facilities, the information is even more scattered and difficult to get. In some cases, maybe they are not even licensed.
The first of these plants were built when the electrification of the U.S. was taking place, and many were in the form of mill dams. There was a resurgence of these smaller facilities in the 1980s, and there's another happening now.
Later in the 1980s, you had the energy crisis and policy changes, which brought up renewed interest in hydro, particularly small hydro, and then you're seeing that again now. Particularly adding power to sort of existing infrastructure, like you have dams without power, you have irrigation canals and conduits that could have power added to them, and those facilities are typically small as well.
The report also outlines how hydropower generation differs from all other energy generation in the U.S.
The facilities where hydropower equipment is installed and that are producing hydropower are also doing other things. That, I think, sets hydropower apart from any other electricity generation technology we can think of. The reservoirs are providing recreation, flood control, enabling navigation.
When you have hydropower within a system of the power system, particularly when you look at something integrated like TVA, you can use how you move water through that system and how you generate electricity to support all your other functions. So that's providing cooling water to your nuclear and coal plants. So hydropower is there not just as its own electricity generating source, but the flexibility it provides and the water management capabilities you have with it can support more electricity generation technologies.
Patrick O'Connor and Rocio Oria Martinez are energy analysts at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory and co-authors of the first major report on U.S. hydropower. You can find a link to the report on our webpage, WUOT.org. I'm Chrissy Kuiper, WUOT News.
Last week, about 8,000 middle and high school students from 48 states and 20 nations came right here to Knoxville. They were here to learn how to solve problems using science, math, art, and design. The confab is called Destination Imagination Global Finals.
My name is Vincent Savasco. I'm a senior from Mason High School. Our team was lucky enough to make it to the global competition of Destination Imagination this year.
Vincent, or Vinny to his friends, is from Ohio, and the team he's talking about is one of many teams that were assigned to address hypothetical problems. Vinny's team ended up selecting a challenge set in the world of fairy tales, specifically the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
A man who gets hired by a kingdom to lead rats away from a town. And then when the kingdom doesn't pay him, he uses his magical flute to lure away children. Ours is the aftermath of that story, and we go in-depth, branching really into what does it mean to be afraid of music, and what does it mean to be afraid of kind of yourself and your past.
Vinny's team had a few weeks to get ready to present their ideas.
So we go out, we buy the materials, we have a budget that we're not allowed to go over. And so mostly our materials consist of, you know, wood and cardboard and glue and paint and that kind of thing.
All this may sound lighthearted and playful, but there is an underlying foundation at Destination Imagination that stresses creativity and critical thinking.
Honestly, they really want to promote each individual the power to really just create and go out there and explore and do what humans were designed to do best, and that's just design and use our brains.
Some of the students who came to Destination Imagination's global finals in Knoxville last week will get scholarships for their work. Savasco, who just graduated from high school himself this month, is off to continue his education too.
Yeah, so after high school, I will be attending the University of Cincinnati, and my plan is to actually go more towards the art and kind of design field. I really liked the idea of having something tangible that was close to home, something that I created, and I could see it through from beginning to end.
As in Vinny Savasco's case, being successful in Destination Imagination programs could be a starting point for students who are looking for jobs in science, technology, or design. Looking around the exhibition hall, I saw banners for technology firms, Disney, and even NASA. Last Thursday, Buzz Aldrin came by to talk with the Destination Imagination students. But when I asked him, Savasco said he didn't think the moon is in his future, at least not yet.
I have a fear of heights, but honestly, I would love, I think, one day to go to space. I think it'd be terrific. Not sure I'm ready for it to be a career choice.
So maybe not today, but that's okay because Destination Imagination, it seems, is really all about tomorrow. A final note, this one about another young person using science to solve problems. Virginia High School student Cameron Roberts carrying out his own project using the Oak Ridge National Lab High Flux Isotope Reactor. Roberts wanted to learn more about how radiation affects materials that are exposed in space for long periods of time. That kind of knowledge would be valuable to people planning manned and unmanned missions to other planets that often take months or years. Cameron discovered that when he exposed plastic samples to radiation, they did not break down or weaken the way he thought they would. The paper he wrote describing his results was accepted to the Virginia Junior Academy of Science Research Symposium held this month. And ORNL reports Roberts is planning a trip this summer to see the facility and meet the staff who helped him with his project. That does it for this edition of The Method. Remember, you can listen to all of our past shows online at WUOT.org. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.